Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Need Some Introduction. I'm your host, Victor, and in this podcast, I recommend and discuss new movies, music, and mostly television, and hopefully introduce all of you to something new to watch, listen to, or enjoy. In today's episode, I will be breaking down the career of Alex Garland, one of the most interesting creators in the past decade or so, an artist that I almost always have very complicated feelings about the success of what he's attempting to do in these films, TV series, books that he's written and been involved with, and yet always so intellectually stimulated by his work. And I'm doing this, of course, as Civil War is about to come out, has not yet been released in the US, and will probably be number one at the box office this weekend. Remains to be seen. This is A24, the studio producing it, by far their most expensive production, so they have high hopes for this. And in this episode, I will do a rundown of Garland's career, some thematic fascinations as a preview to going to see Civil War, hopefully some context for you if you're not familiar with his career, walking through with spoiler-free reviews of most of his films, and then I will have a spoiler-free and then a spoiler, full spoiler review of Civil War. I'll warn you when the spoilers begin, and also here going through some of the highlights of his career. Before we get into the Garland retrospective, I have another post-apocalyptic review for you here. Newly available on Amazon Prime is the video game adaptation Fallout. This comes from Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, the same creators of HBO's Westworld adaptation and last year's The Peripheral, which we covered here on the show. Now, honestly, given that pedigree, I was actually skeptical to try this out. I wanted to sample it. Video game adaptations are having a moment here, so I have a feeling that this was going to be popular, so I wanted to at least sample it, but I had my misgivings. First of all, probably halfway through season two of Westworld, I started to become pretty skeptical about that whole entire project, and by the time we got to season four, I couldn't even watch the show. I probably saw almost half of that season and honestly cannot remember anything that happened there. So I felt like that was really squandered. I then covered here on the podcast The Peripheral and felt really disappointed with how little that show did at all in season one. Really, it felt like a full setup, just a complete setup for a season two, which will not come now. This is a huge problem I have with TV shows in the past few years since the streaming content onslaught began. So many of these shows are all set up for a second season and deliver very little in season one. And I think that's why so many of them are failing, to be honest. It was a calculation across the board, make everything into a puzzle box that'll keep people on the hook for another season. If they don't watch season one, they're not coming back for season two. Hate to break it to all of you. All that is to say, I was wary. Also have a problem in general with video game adaptations, to be honest. The Last of Us really can't imagine a more handsomely produced adaptation of any video game. And yet that show really did feel incomplete in so many ways to me. So I have seen episode one, only episode one. The entire show is available. By the way, this is on Amazon Prime. If you don't have Amazon Prime, by the way, you can watch the first episode, which is all I've seen, once again, on Freevee. So anybody can watch it. And my first impressions are that I was pretty knocked out by this first episode. Now, grain of salt there. I remember seeing the very first episode of Westworld and recommending it to everybody I knew, saying like, this is maybe one of the best pilot episodes I've seen of anything. So can't judge these folks by their pilot episodes, honestly, but I'm really intrigued. From what I know, I do not know anything of the video game. I hear that this has the backdrop and some of the iconography of the show, of the video game, I should say, but a completely unique storyline. So should be fine for novices to follow along. I found it, the scope of the production here, absolutely flabbergasting. Like some of these sequences of this nuclear fallout and some of the special effects sequences here are just absolutely stunning. Compared to, for example, my expectations after seeing The Peripheral, that things were going to be pretty low, you know, kind of cheesy on the cheap looking. And boy, this is incredible. The special effects are some of the best I've seen, way better than like Marvel movies, for example. So very impressed that they have spent this amount of money on this and very curious to see where the season one goes. So I am recommending this. Check out the pilot and check out the trailer that plays at the end of the pilot. The scope of this seems truly immense. And another thing, I often have this issue with video game adaptations. They'll often throw this like very goofy comedy in and then try to mesh it in with these darker themes. They've kind of avoided that here by having almost parallel stories. Some of it is kind of goofy, and then other aspects of it are extremely grim, but very realistic in the character psychology, for example, that we're seeing among some of these characters with darker motivations. But they've split the storylines apart to allow these different tones to exist almost in their own parallel storylines. But assuming that they're all going to merge together, not sure how that's all going to play out. But I am really interested. All that is to say, I am really interested by this really stunningly realized world and curious to see what the mythology is. There is certainly going to be a broader conspiracy that will be revealed over the course of the show. And maybe, like The Peripheral, and maybe like Westworld, it will all fall flat on its face. And maybe there's a curse in, for example, taking a story like Westworld and dragging it down for too many seasons. So maybe the best thing that could happen is that it has maybe just a 2-year run if they have a very tight story to tell in those circumstances. All that is to say, I'm wary, but very impressed, especially with the production here. Really beautifully directed by Nolan and show run by the couple. And yeah, all the production here is just absolutely top. So do check that out. And if I watch the rest of it and enjoy the rest of it, I will try to watch it over the course of the next week or so. Check in next week, and I will probably have a full spoiler review and breakdown of that show in next week's episode. Late next week. Give me some extra time. These are very long episodes. Also a reminder, reach out to us, needsomeintroduction@gmail.com. Give us your feedback on any of the shows you've been watching recently or feedback on our content here as well. And follow me on Letterboxd if you don't want to remember to write down all those recommendations and those capsule reviews of Garland's films. Check out the show notes. I'll have a link to another list on Letterboxd, or follow me on Letterboxd. Okay, so let's get into the breakdown of Garland's career to this point. Garland's father was a political cartoonist, and his grandfather was a novelist, so you see some of his pedigree and his interests right within his family. And importantly, his mother was a psychologist. The political satire and exploration of topics may very well have come from his father's political cartoons and his father's interest in politics. He began as a novelist, just like his grandfather. But as we'll go through these films, you'll see that the psychology of these characters, even in these science fiction dystopias oftentimes, are his primary interest. How does technology change our psychology? In his early 20s, as was trendy at the time among British youths, he did a lot of backpacking, traveling to exotic locales around the world, specifically Thailand. And he saw while he was there a lot of these European travelers who were into the drug and music culture of the time, the rave culture of the time, who on paper were good progressives, good liberals, who were concerned about the exploitation of these third world countries. And yet he saw the irony and the hypocrisy of this very travel industry, these young adults traveling to these locales and in a lot of ways exploiting them, destroying them, but also getting into way too much trouble, not realizing that there is an undercurrent, a dark underbelly to these impoverished areas that you don't see in the travel brochures. All of this led to him writing the book, The Beach. Now, if the plot sounds familiar, what I just described there, you've probably seen Danny Boyle's film, The Beach, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Significantly different than the book. The book was a success in Britain. It was read by many people of this generation, of this age group, these young 20s. He was in his late 20s at this point, who had friends or were planning to or had already explored these exotic locales. And of course, was adapted to a not very successful Hollywood film. I did revisit it for the first time, actually. Now, I shouldn't say I revisited it. I did read the book and watch the film for the first time. I'm always interested in adaptation and how the book, the story, makes it to the screen. Just for example, in the most recent podcast episode, we were discussing the book versus the series Ripley on Netflix. That film actually, beyond its reputation, was actually pretty financially successful. However, considering it was DiCaprio's follow-up to Titanic, was expected to be much bigger than it was. And also, since Danny Boyle at the moment, coming off of Trainspotting, was considered a very hot property and everybody was very curious to see what he would do next, and he was adapting this incredibly popular book, especially in England, the film was considered a bit of a disappointment, but it made money nonetheless. This, of course, is very important for a couple of reasons. In the context of Alex Garland's career, he wasn't that happy with that adaptation. And of course, Danny Boyle directed that movie, So this began a relationship between him and Danny Boyle. And once again, the book published in 1996. He's only 26 years old, writing this novel right out of college. Just 4 years later, in 2000, the film comes out, raises the profile of the novel even more. And of course, he begins to work with Danny Boyle and writes the script for Danny Boyle's follow-up film, 2002's 28 Days Later. Now, I might forget to circle back to this, so I do want to mention that Danny Boyle is currently, if you're curious about this, if you like the 28 Days Later film, currently working with Danny Boyle to bring 28 years later to the screen, the third of the films in the 28 series. And Cillian Murphy is coming back, coming off of his Oscar nomination to play the lead role too. So very exciting, quite an exciting package. And probably within the next year or two, we'll see that film. 28 Days Later was a big comeback for Danny Boyle at the time, as well as being Garland's first screenwriting credit. Now, even in that film, we start to see, if you haven't seen that film, it is a zombie apocalypse film. It's not really a zombie film, by the way, nothing supernatural. These aren't actual dead people. These are people who are infected with a virus, which makes them basically rabid. They just want to pass on the virus to other people and will kill them. And they infect very, very quickly. These are fast zombies, as they call them in the nomenclature, if you're a zombie fan, that these are not the slow, lumbering George Romero zombies. These are the fast-moving zombies because they're not even dead. They're not really zombies, specific about it. But this is an incredibly influential film. This is before the onslaught of thousands of zombie films that became all the vogue for a decade at least and have seemed to have toned down recently, although there's still multiple Walking Dead spinoffs out now. But we did have about 10 years of nothing but zombie movies, pretty much, it felt like. Another theme here, interestingly, that emerges even this early on is his fascination with video game culture. There's a whole digression, as a matter of fact, in the film, The Beach, accentuated even more, this idea of being inside of a video game. In the book, he simply is obsessed with a video game at one point as an escape from the realities around him, the protagonist, that is. And in this case, 28 Days Later, this movie was very much influenced by video games, such as Resident Evil, for example. But Garland does explore the way that video game culture may impact our society as well. Another interesting point in 28 Days Later, if you haven't seen the film, I won't go into anything too spoilerish, although it's not really the type of film that you can spoil, to be totally honest, but the skepticism around military control or really any kind of totalitarian control, even in the context of a zombie outbreak, is first explored here. And that skepticism around the military, the lure of someone granting you protection and simultaneously thwarting your free will, is something that is explored here. And by the way, will show back up again to its fullest in Civil War. Speaking of video game adaptations, he next attempted an adaptation of the video game Halo, a film that never was produced. It is now in its second season on Paramount Plus. I have never watched that show, to be honest with you. I've heard mostly positive things about it, but once again, for the purposes of our conversation, I do not believe they reused any of Garland's original take. But I do want to mention it because here it is again, his interest in video gaming and how it impacts what we watch and the culture at large. He reteamed with Danny Boyle in a very underseen, I think still very underseen film, which is very hard to find to stream. I actually was trying to find this to stream to put as a recommendation and couldn't find a convenient place. And the film is called Sunshine. And it's about a international all-star cast, by the way, of everybody in that film has gone on to become even more famous. We have Cillian Murphy, of course, just winning an Academy Award. We have Chris Evans, of course, Captain America. We have Rose Byrne, who's been in 100 things, including Bridesmaids since then. We have Michelle Yeoh, who, of course, just won an Academy Award just a couple years ago for Anything, Everywhere, All at Once. We have Cliff Curtis, now in everything, Avatar, The Meg, Hobbs and Shaw, Benedict Wong, Mark Strong, and Hiroyuki Sanada, who's just currently just killing it on Shogun. But just an incredible cast. So track this movie down. I know it's hard to find, but I have, and I know you're going to have issues with the last third of the film where it almost becomes like a very high-tech slasher film and simultaneously becomes extremely hallucinatory. But I got to tell you, watch this on a big screen. The action sequences in the first two-thirds of this film, this is a mission of astronauts headed to the sun to reboot the sun. The sun is dying and Earth is getting colder and they need to re-inseminate the sun. And I use that intentionally, by the way. The visuals of this film are incredible. And you basically have this ship shaped like a sperm heading towards this giant ovum that is the sun. And it's just the logistics of how do these people survive to even pull off this mission. But of course, there's the additional fact that there has been a failed mission that made it almost all the way to the sun and is just floating out there. And what happened to that original crew? So you have that kind of haunted spaceship movie, which we've seen before in Event Horizon and other films like that. And we have this very speculative, more naturalistic science fiction. Once again, a callback to Civil War, a very realistic portrayal of what might have occurred. But then this psychedelic ending, which we'll reference other psychedelic endings in the end of his films as well. The psychedelic part doesn't work as well for me. The slasher movie, this murder spree, doesn't really work as well for me. But everything leading up to it is absolutely 10 out of 10, and visually, some of the most stunning visuals you'll see. Of course, that's Danny Boyle again, and this is not directed by Alex Garland, but you can imagine how Boyle had an influence to some extent in Garland's visual style as well. Next, he wrote the screenplay for another very underseen science fiction film, another adaptation, by the way, but not of his own book. He adapted Kazuo Ishiguro's Never Let Me Down. Another alternate history, it's a spoiler just to tell you the premise of the film, so I'll leave it there. This film doesn't fully work for me, not the way that is not as successful as the novel itself, but it is often heartbreaking, has some great performances, is really visually beautiful. And here we have Garland just as an adapter, but you see him gravitating to these dystopian alternate histories. Then in 2012, we have another pivot point here. He works on the comic book adaptation Dredd, based on the Judge Dredd comic books. He writes the screenplay, but more importantly, he had a very specific visual style he wanted for the film itself. And the reports are that he basically took over directing duties. The credited director is Peter Travis, but Garland was not only the person who spoke to the actors to improve their performances, but was also in post-production, very interested, really took control of the visual effects. If you haven't seen this film before, and I do recommend it as long as you're not squeamish about violence. Honestly, there's so much hyper-violence in so many of these films I'm about to describe that you probably aren't squeamish if you're listening this far into this episode. And this film is really thrilling, by the way. It's so contained. It's very much like the film The Raid, which came out the same year, where you have a drug gang inside of a high-rise and basically working from level to level, once again, very much like a video game, not surprisingly, to clear out the bad guys. Now, unlike The Raid, where the bad guys are explicitly the bad guys and almost superhumanly talented at murdering the good guys, and there's the one lone survivor that needs to battle his way through, there is a lot of ambiguity here, moral ambiguity here, as to Judge Dredd, who is this judge, jury, executioner, who's basically there to kill everybody in the building. They could just be there to get high, just addicts or users. Everybody gets the equal execution judgment. And this drug they take makes everything, I think it's called slow-mo, it slows everything down. And we get to see these incredibly violent sequences in incredible slow motion. You see bullets passing through people's faces and things like that. It's incredible visuals, beautiful and grotesque at the same time. Once again, something that we will see more of in his subsequent films. And at that point, when he took over control of this film, this is when he officially becomes a writer/director. And that begins with A24, this starting a young production company, released Ex Machina in 2014. This film stars Domhnall Gleeson, Alicia Vikander, and Oscar Isaac. Once again, relatively early in their ascent to fame, he's incredible at casting, finding these people who are about to be huge. The film had a very limited release in the United States. A24 at the time did not have a huge distribution company. However, it just hung around in theaters week after week and eventually made $25 million in the US and more overseas, but much more importantly, has become a huge hit on streaming DVD, et cetera. I think on Netflix at one point had it. It was at number one, this is a few years ago, when it was released there. And to this day, his most beloved film, I think, among general film critics and audiences as well. I just rewatched this very recently in preparation for this retrospective. And this really holds up. This is very much a film noir set in this incredibly beautiful hotel. There's a famously beautiful sparse hotel in Iceland, I believe, which is actually supposed to be the getaway or this fortress of solitude for the Oscar Isaac character. And in this film, Domhnall Gleeson arrives. He has been selected. He works at this very high-tech Facebook-style company. When he arrives at this beautiful, out-of-the-way locale, he encounters the Oscar Isaac character, who's very much a Elon Musk-type genius who perhaps is overstating his genius, is maybe over-relying on the chemicals he takes for some of his prowess, but nonetheless has invented something quite unique. He believes that he has created an AI person who will pass the Turing test, basically convince somebody that they are alive. Very prescient in a way, not prescient, I guess, because it was already happening at the time, but a very interesting movie to revisit, if you haven't revisited in a while, in the context now of this discussion of AI and large language models. And it raises many really interesting questions. A few things we start to see here in Garland's style. First of all, he strips things back, way back. He makes his casts much smaller. He really is interested in putting people in isolation and then having them interact really just one-on-one. This is such a small cast of characters in this movie for the vast majority of it. And yet those three characters don't even interact with each other on screen at the same time. It is very much one person interacting with another person and then relaying that information to someone else or the other person observing their two interactions. He really is fixated on not people in a large crowd, but people in a small group or even just intimately. Why do we talk to each other? Why do we lie to each other? How do we manipulate each other with the truth oftentimes? But the film isn't only about that. It's not only about these interactions and how we behave in isolation and the danger of isolating ourselves and how we become almost a feral versions of ourselves when we don't have cultural feedback, something we saw, for example, all the way back in The Beach. But now he starts to get into these very muddy moral questions. We have this Vikander character who is the AI. I guess that's a minor spoiler, but what else could it be? And she is intentionally made to be sexy. But you think about the fact that Gleason is attracted to her, but she barely has a form when you see her. You don't even see her body because she's practically translucent. The special effects are absolutely incredible here. This year, the film won Best Special Effects, believe it or not, against some, you know, giant profile films. And the special effects are absolutely stunning. As a matter of fact, the film has just been reissued in IMAX just a couple of weeks ago. I did not see it, but everybody who saw it in IMAX was like, I don't even know if this is going to be required viewing in IMAX, other than some of these beautiful scenery. But people were so impressed in their reaction that the special effects are so convincing, even blown up to that size. And all that is to say that it's completely convincing. It's this amazing way that her body's practically translucent. She does it opposite of a striptease over the course of the film as she adds more clothes, but it gives her body more form. So he practically can't even see her. She just has a face and very little else of her is not mechanical. And yet Gleason gets to fall in love with her and is even sexually attracted to her, despite the fact that he basically has to imagine the person that he is talking to. And there's something very explicit that's being said there about our interactions with each other and how most of those interactions are an invention. So it becomes about that, about how we convince ourselves we're attracted to somebody in some ways, how we invent the person in our own minds. And of course, that's how the AI in a lot of ways are potentially able to convince you. If the AI is not truly sentient, then it's your imagination that it is. So you are filling in those gaps in the way you choose to perceive it. You can perceive it as, yes, definitely, this is a sentient being. Or you could be like, absolutely not. And it's almost impossible to convince yourself of one or the other, because you're basically just interacting with that version of that being in your mind. All of this is really fascinating stuff, but it goes into more muddy themes. Even beyond that, we have to ask ourselves, if you have created this thing, if you've given it life, what's your responsibility to set it free? And there's the whole idea of parenting, or the whole idea of the master and slave, for example. And if we consider that we were able to build these AIs, would we then, if we make them work for us, if we make them do our bidding, aren't we simply enslaving them because we've now made them so convincingly human only so that we can turn them into our worker bees? So lots of food for thought here. And importantly, I think that he keeps the plot light. He keeps the interactions vague. And this minimalist approach allows the viewer to superimpose their own readings, their own interpretations onto the material. And once again, that will be relevant again in my review of Civil War. After the enormous success of Ex Machina, 4 years later, Garland adapted the novel Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer This film actually even made more money at the box office, and he's had troubled productions in general, other than Ex Machina, honestly. But even Dread was a troubled production, and Sunshine was actually, I think, very successful, but financially was kind of dumped in movie theaters. And once Annihilation was complete, it struggled to even get released. Eventually, Paramount did release it in the US. They pretty much dumped it, despite having Natalie Portman coming off of her Academy Award win. But it actually found an audience and eventually legged out to about $30 million in the US. It made much less money overseas, but pretty much was sold to Netflix for worldwide distribution and has its proponents for sure. However, this film is far less well-liked among critics and fans as well. This is a very messy and, by the way, very loose adaptation of the Vandermeer novel. Interesting that he started by having his work adapted and now has basically been adapting other people's work. And in this movie and in the book as well, there's something called the shimmer in the Everglades of Florida that is causing an acceleration of mutations within its confines. Oscar Isaac leads a paramilitary group into this area to explore, and nobody survives except for him. He's in a relationship with the Natalie Portman character. And when he returns and he's practically catatonic, she ends up going with a group of all-female scientists on the same mission. And then what we experience is their perspective from inside the shimmer as they lose time, as things start to change around them. This is not a fully successful film. However, it has some of the most utterly bracing body horror you could imagine as we start to see nature around them starting to mutate as they themselves begin to mutate. And the visuals are so striking. There really is this obsession or fascination with the way that nature recycles itself, how decay leads to life again. Simultaneously, we see these characters, all of them pretty much seem to be depressive, and the film isn't fully able to bridge that gap. But I still recommend this very highly if you like this kind of very intellectual sci-fi, because there are some very big questions being asked here about our place in nature, about what happens when nature usurps us, right? Potentially, if we want to read a through line between this film and the previous one, what happens when AI replaces us? If they evolve beyond us, what would our place be in the world? And in this film, since we are just piece of nature, what happens when nature itself reclaims the world around us? It also features some of the most disturbing images. There is, I once again don't want to spoil this, but there is a creature in this film that is really, really memorable and just one of the most crazy things you'll ever see. So even just for that, just for the incredible visuals, the incredible design work here on a relatively small budget, he's able to do a lot. Coming right off of Annihilation, he began working on an FX series called Devs. Now, perhaps out of all of his works, this is the one that I had the most trouble engaging with. This series very much keeps us at arm's length, although it does explore these really fascinating ideas as it progresses. But I would say if you have a similar reaction to me where you feel very cold about the series after the first episode, let's say, stick with it, because not only does the film become surprisingly emotionally powerful, the coldness that you're reading in the series itself may be intentional. Like, I don't want to spoil anything, but let's just say there might be something being revealed in the antiseptic feel of the film, or this series, I should say. This film stars, for the first time in his films, Anoya Mizuno, who we see briefly in Civil War, and actually has been in all of his projects. This is by far her biggest role. This is an actress that I don't always engage with, I have to say. She's on House of the Dragon as well. I have many problems with her on that series, more so than I do here. But maybe my biggest problem with Devs is having her so central in this series. An actress I just simply do not engage with very much. She started off as a dancer. She is very striking in Ex Machina, for example. But having a whole movie on her back seems to be more than she can handle, especially at this point in her career. And she works at another giant IT compound led by Nick Offerman, which we will see again, of course, in Civil War, and features terrific performances by Stephen McKinley Henderson, who we'll see in Civil War, and we just saw in the first Dune movie, and Kaylee Spani, talk about getting somebody early in their career, who just had a year now appearing in the film Priscilla, playing Priscilla Presley, and now also one of the stars of Civil War. And there's a murder mystery at the center of Dev, so once again, it starts to feel a bit like a film noir, definitely a genre that he has played with multiple times. And over the course of this investigation, we start to understand the project itself. It turns out that Nick Offerman has a tragedy in his past that he is trying to understand how it could have been avoided. And he has built a supercomputer that can take in all of the facts leading up to an event and basically predict its future. So he's trying to create this predictive engine, basically. Once again, the idea of this predictive algorithms we're using today for large language models. And he's constantly frustrated because he thinks there's a bug in what he's seeing, in that there's only a probability of an outcome. But he is trying to prove that time is linear. There's only one possibility of events from beginning to end. He does not believe in the multiverse. This is contentious within scientific communities. In a nutshell, if you could go back in time, change events, and therefore change your future, then there cannot be just one arrow of time. There must be multiversal times. There must be different versions of times. If you can potentially change the past, in other words, then that has to exist somewhere in the universe, but we don't see it visually. There must be multiverses that are parallel. By the way, this is a complicated idea, but I think everyone's familiar with it now because we have 5,000 multiverse, you know, whether it's Spider-Man, whether it's the Marvel films, whether it's the DC films, whether it's all of those comic book stories in the past and into the future, I'm sure, or even just Everything Everywhere All at Once, there's another multiverse movie. So I guess we're all familiar with multiverses now, but the question becomes, is there a multiverse or not? And sometimes even when you know the answer and you refuse to see what's right in front of you. So there's these ideas of when you can be almost too smart for yourself, when you can ignore facts to bend to your belief system. And then also, what would the possibilities be if there was a machine like this that could predict future events? So a lot of food for thought. This should have been a movie, and it's way too long as a series, although especially in some of those episodes where we see Offerman's backstory, the extra time is used pretty well. It is still too long, but really fascinating, and it does land an emotional punch by its end. And that's Devs on FX from 2020. It's hard to judge what a streaming success or failure is and how much prestige a show is supposed to bring. I assume in my estimation that Devs was a flop. I think it was pretty expensive. I think it had a mixed critical reaction, although mostly positive. I think audiences were confused oftentimes by it. The ratings weren't that great, has not had a long tail culturally, I don't believe. And it did not win a lot of awards or get a lot of nominations or anything like that. So I think in general, this was probably considered one of the bigger flops of his career, but not as big a flop as I think a very misunderstood and very maligned film from 2021, which was his follow-up, a movie called Men. Now, this film is practically a two-person film. There's actually another important character here. We have Jesse Buckley playing a woman who's just had her husband die, and Rory Kinnear playing every other man she encounters in this movie. And she goes on a vacation in this absolutely beautiful British countryside. And now we go back to his themes of isolation. We really are inside of Jesse Buckley's mind. The first half of this movie, I have got to tell you, I have lots of problems with the second half. I actually do modestly like this film. I think it's really maligned. People hate this film. I actually think it's pretty fascinating, not fully successful at what it's trying to do. But the first half of this movie is absolutely fantastic. Looks incredible. Just being so intimate just with Jesse Buckley as she just walks through this incredible countryside dealing with this trauma she's just experienced. And then the creeping sense of something supernatural, of the fact that eventually we discover, once we recognize that all the men in the film are all being played by Rory Kinnear, we start to know that there's something very, very wrong going on here. For me, I think where this film probably loses me is in the very, very end, when we get to this, once again, a completely psychedelic ending to this film, where there's a big question as to whether what we're seeing here has any basis in reality or whether it's purely psychological. And then rather than leaving things ambiguous, which I'm actually okay with, there are multiple signifiers in the final moments of this film that would force either a literal read or a purely psychological read, and leaving things so oddly undefined doesn't work in this particular case. However, I still support this film. Now, to appreciate it, if you are really interested in Alex Garland's career, I see this as almost a mirror image film to Ex Machina, whereas instead of having this questioning of this female character, who's trapped inside of this room in this facility. I'm talking about Ex Machina now. We have this woman who's trapped in this huge open space, but not trapped physically, trapped by her own trauma. And then we have many different men coming in to talk to her, but of course, with all the same face of this man, the Rory Kinnear character, really not the character because he represents multiple people here. And there's this layer of nature, of course, if you want to see this as kind of a culmination of his filmography until that point, we have the way that nature invades the body, like we saw in Annihilation as well. And also the idea of this violence that is cyclical and returns and how it's reborn. And that's a lot of the imagery we see at the end of the film as well. Some really shocking and memorable images here. And when it's purely psychologically investigating the Jesse Buckley character's reflections on this trauma she's gone through, the film works really, really well. I mean, it's so strange to have a film really derail itself so completely in those just final shots. But once again, the more vague you would leave this, I think, the more interesting the film is. Honestly, as a standalone piece of work, I don't know if you're going to watch this and just be like, I have no context and I'm going to enjoy this film. As a culmination thematically to a lot of Garland's interests until this point, I would say it is an interesting watch, but for fans only, let's say. Even if you don't like it, by the way, you really should watch it if you are an Alex Garland fan. Caveat in place. And I really do feel like he's closing the door there. This, of course, all leads us to Civil War, which is opening this weekend. Looking like not only is it his most expensive film, it is A24's biggest production at about $50 million. This film is very intimate. It has a bunch of just four people, I should say, inside of a car traversing the U.S. in the grip of this nationwide civil war. And yet, when it gets big, and if you've seen the trailer, you have seen some of this imagery. The invasion of Washington, D.C. is enormous. It is enormous and utterly breathtaking in its horrific implications. So it really feels very different. It gets very large, has a large cast. It's very action-based. It openly is an action movie for large sections of it. So in so many ways, does not feel like a Garland movie, but in its confrontational and questioning stance and its ambiguity, really in its screenplay, very much an Alex Garland film. And as the film opens, we have the context that the president, Nick Offerman, who is now in his third term, illegally, as far as many of the people who are fighting this civil war against him would believe, he's basically trying to maintain this existing government where these, what's called the Western forces, which is California and Texas, an interesting choice. First of all, two enormous states, obviously. The two states together are nearly a third of the American population, are at war with DC, the existing government. Now, very importantly, we do not hear this person is a right winger, this person is a left winger, this person is a Democrat, this person is a Republican. Importantly, the coalition of states that are fighting the civil war, California, the biggest liberal state in the country, and Texas, a population-wise, vote-wise, a swing state, practically a swing state, you know, within a couple of percentage points. However, politically, a conservative cornerstone. Really, Texas is the powerhouse of the Republican control of the House of Representatives, for example. So in having this union of these two states, it leaves things open as to, well, if we want to talk about our current political discourse, is this a democratically led? Is this Republican led? We know the president is in a third term, which of course is currently illegal. So is he a fascist or is he stuck in office because this is a civil war that he's going to lose and no one else wants the position? Maybe he's just stuck there as a figurehead and has to ride this war out. And very intentionally, we do not know. We don't know what the ideology is here. And I think that is extremely important. Early on in the film, it is stated that the photojournalist's job is to not take a side, but simply to witness. And that is basically what the film is doing. It is not taking a side. It's letting us witness what we're seeing there. But then, of course, there is a lot of ambiguity here as to what Garland is trying to tell us in taking no sides. Are we supposed to say, let's look at this civil war in the context of how we watch civil wars in other countries, whether that be in African nations or Middle Eastern nations? We are just bystanders watching that from a distance. But imagine our same remove of just being tourists, just watching what's happening without picking a side, just watching it as observers of history, what happens when this is intimately happening within our own borders? It really does give you a different feel. And I'm going to tell you, honestly, this movie was thrilling at times, but nauseating at the same time. There are moments in this film where I can't even describe my physical reaction to it, where it's so convincing in its on-the-street war footage, but not in the way you see a thrilling action sequence in a Marvel film or something like that. Suddenly putting it in the context of the country tearing itself apart literally nauseated me in the theater. And I think that is, to some extent, the intention. In the film, Kirsten Dunst plays a character called Lee, who is a photojournalist. She's on a trip to D.C. They're planning to interview the president, assuming that the government's going to fall, and trying to get his last interview. She's with Wagner Moura, who we just saw in Mr. and Mrs. Smith, by the way. Excellent here as well. There's an older colleague played by Stephen McKinley Henderson from Devs, as I mentioned earlier, an older photojournalist as well. Lee has a relationship with him, and he piggybacks onto their trip. He only wants to go to Charlottesville. He does not want to go to D.C. He sees that as a suicide mission, but he does want to tag along for part of the trip. And lastly, Kaylee Spaney, who Lee rescues from a suicide bombing. Unrecognizable here, just in jeans and a t-shirt, having just seen her in Priscilla, playing Priscilla Presley, all dolled up in her 50s style. 60s, I guess, 60s style. And she's a huge fan of Lee, but also very green, has no experience in the field, and basically just wants to be a photojournalist. And then as they go on this trip to DC, we see them encounter kind of what we've seen in other dystopian type films. There is a mistrust. There is anarchy. There is vigilante justice. There's the collapse of the US dollar. They have to buy things in Canadian dollars. But very much it is about witnessing this collapse. And in some ways, I think that this is, and this is open to interpretation, I think there will be a lot of negative takes on this film, that the film doesn't have a moral perspective, and in a way that is craven, so that it appeals to both people on the left and the right. And maybe strategically, this is smart from a marketing standpoint, because this film is targeted to open very well this weekend. But I think that isn't even the intention in making this a non-politically focused film. I think Garland's intention here is, first of all, to make us look at all those people out there who are just like, you know what? We got to just tear things up. We just got to tear it down. The system doesn't work anymore. These are people on the left. These are people on the right. These are both on both sides that people are just like, we need to start over. And this is to say, what happens? What does that actually feel like in realistic terms? What does really doing a hard reset of our system look like, and conveying it in a realistic way, not the fantasy simplicity of a lot of populist rhetoric out there. But I think there's another intention here as well. These photojournalists that are just simply witnessing the world around them, I think there's a bit of a critique here, maybe a self-critique as well as a filmmaker, because that's what he's doing here. He is a bystander who is simply recording this for entertainment purposes to a large extent. And that's what these photojournalists are doing. And that's what we do every single day as well, right? They're out there not making change, but reacting to it, making their content, basically their social media posts, right? In this case, their photographs, out of this war that is breaking out all around them. And to them, it simply has become part of the product that they produce. And there is a thrill in being there, in being a part of the history, of recording it. But then how complicit are we in the atrocities we witness here when we are willing to exploit them for ourselves? And the film very intelligently allows us to have the visceral thrills early on. Audience members laughed out loud over multiple sequences here where there's a lot of grim comedy in what we're watching. Some of the deaths here in the film are gut-wrenching, and yet others are played for laughs with Say No Go, for example, the great De La Soul song with the Hall & Oates sample as musical accompaniment. Large sequences here in the film take place within the confines of the cabin of the car itself, and it works really well. It's also a way to constrain the budget, by the way. You shoot half the movie in one car. You shoot the other half of the movie as huge spectacle with the night skies lit up and tanks driving down the roads through major U.S. cities. Now, if there's a criticism, you can say, we don't know anything about these characters, but I was invested in them, honestly, because I think that's, once again, a point in the film. that in this circumstance, you wouldn't know these people intimately. You wouldn't know their full biography. You just see them reacting to what's happening around them. And in this case, the threat of death is constant. Also, those long sequences in the car are very reminiscent of seeing the dystopia from a very intimate car eye view from Children of Men, by the way. If you've never seen that, so definitely check that out. A cornerstone and definitely an influence on this film here. The little details of this world, this abandoned world as they drive through it, are incredibly well realized. The music, the cinematography, the needle drops, all really impeccable. Like, this is absolutely one of the best directed films of the past year, and a real step up just in scale for Garland as well. Okay, minor spoilers here. I won't go into specific spoilers, but you may want to skip ahead to the next section of the podcast, check the show notes, or jump ahead about 5 minutes. For me, the film really was working for me all the way through, but then there is a moment, and this is just pure cinema, just this incredible confluence of performance and music and images, when one of our leads has been shot and is dying, and we're driving through this burning forest, and this Sturgill Simpson song is playing on the soundtrack, and this idea that life is just a dream, which is echoed once again in the suicide song we hear at the end of the film, Dream Baby Dream. But this sequence is just like the highlight of the film for me. It was just magical in its sadness and its loss of hope. And that all leads to this angry confrontation in DC, where now, if we had any question at this point as to whether we should see these people as heroes for putting their necks on the line to record this, or suicidal thrill seekers, or straight up vultures that are feeding on this misery, I think it's pretty clear that these people are non-heroic by the time we get to the end, and they are desperately putting their lives on the line and risking the lives of the people inside of the White House and the soldiers and their cohorts around them, just because they desperately need to get that shot, the final shot of the president before he's assassinated. And this is when the whole thing became gut-churning. Not only the visuals of DC being destroyed, completely convincingly, by the way, but also just to think that you are now fully aligned with these amoral characters who are salivating, especially the Mora character, salivating at the opportunity to witness this atrocity. And really, as I mentioned, makes you question what we all do every day when we are willing to share some comedic meme about the atrocity of the day or the crime of the day, and how we just become totally desensitized to the horrors around us. And not only that, not only desensitized to it, but looking for the next outlandish disaster for just a few more clicks, for just a little more content. So in the end, is this a perfect film? No, but it is nearly perfectly made. Is there maybe too much space in the script? Has he really stripped down? I can imagine him removing and removing and removing context. But that just allows us to apply our own context. And if you read it the way I do, I think you will find it satisfying. If you're waiting for an answer at the end as to who's to blame, and if you wanted this to be didactic, basically, you're going to be disappointed. And I'm very curious to see how audiences react to this. As I mentioned, people laughed out loud at the funny parts in the movie, and there are funny parts. But is this maybe a critique of the audience itself at the end going to turn off a populist audience? I'm very curious to see what the cinema score is going to be on this at the end. And the movie ends once again with that suicide song. A lot of symbolism in the song choices here, by the way. Suicide, arguably one of the characters here commits suicide. And of course, Dream Baby Dream. Once again, the idea that, is this a dream that people are having? This is the fantasy? Or is it saying, sure, go ahead, Dream Baby Dream. I want to reset society. We hear that all the time, and I would assume this is not what the average person is envisioning when they complain about the status quo. One last point there. When I say that, I don't think that Garland, being of the political mindset that he has, is simply saying that we should just go with the flow and accept a totalitarian regime. I think he just wants to convey, as a photojournalist would, that it wouldn't be simple. That would be a very painful birthing process. It would not be the simple pablum that oftentimes our politicians and some of these cultural voices would have us believe. So that's the end of my review of Civil War. We'll see how it does at the box office, and we'll check in next week. At the top of one of the next episodes, I'll have my commentary on this film's box office and the box office so far this year. For next week, Sona and I will be discussing a new time travel rom-com that's coming to Hulu this weekend. I'll give you some other time traveling rom-com recommendations as well. And I'll have my final verdict later in the week on the Fallout series, so stay tuned for all of that. If you'd like to support the show, give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or any podcatcher, however you listen to us. Recommend us to your friends and family, and follow me and reach out to me on Letterboxd. Check the show notes for all the links, and I'll talk to you soon.